You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of July 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
I believe that when all voices are being heard, when people know that they're included in the political process, that makes a country stronger and more successful and more innovative. So we discussed steps that Ethiopia can take to show progress on promoting good governance, protecting human rights, fundamental freedoms, and strengthening democracy.
Barack Obama has praised Ethiopia's role in confronting regional terror. Tim Marshall and Daniela Peled will tell us why and assess the US president's performance on his East African tour. Then we'll shift our sights to another battleground in the war against extremism in Syria and Iraq. We'll ask our guests to what extent Turkish strategy is going to shape the outcome in that particular crucible. Plus, we'll cast a critical eye on Europe too, from Italian calls for greater political integration to Dutch arguments about immigration and assimilation. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome to the programme. My guests today are indeed Tim Marshall and Daniela Peled. Tim Marshall's the editor of the whatandthewhy.com and recently author of Prisoners of Geography. And Daniela Peled is the editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both back to the programme. Great to have you with us as ever. We start today's programme in Ethiopia, where US President Barack Obama became the first ever American president to visit. In a speech given after talks with Ethiopian Prime Minister Desalegn, Obama said that allowing more political freedoms would strengthen the African nation while praising its fight against al-Shabaab. Tim, it's quite interesting. Obama's been quite willing to be fairly critical, especially at some of these big set-piece meetings with his counterparts in the countries that he's visited. Are you impressed by that? Surprised? Unsurprised, perhaps?
I'm unsurprised because he doesn't have to get re-elected and he's in the last 18 months and he doesn't have to deal with any aftermath. But I think he's actually done a good job. I don't often praise his foreign policy. I think he's struck a decent balance. It's no point going in all guns blazing to another country and criticising the left, right and centre. It doesn't get you very far. I was impressed with his remarks in Kenya on homosexuality because he took on corruption as well and everybody cheered. And that's because half the country is poor and realises that the other half are nicking their money. So that was an easy one. Although not for the politicians, but it was an easy one for the crowd. But taking on the homophobia in a country which is overwhelmingly homophobic, I thought that was quite brave. He hasn't done it in Ethiopia, which has 97% homophobic ratings. Kenya's only in the low 90s. But he has taken on Ethiopia a little bit, saying you need better governance. Ethiopia jails more journalists than any other African country except Eritrea. So it's the second, it jails second most in that rather bad list. But here's why he can't go too far. He is relying on Ethiopia, which has a formidable army in African terms, within the African Union to take on al-Shabaab in Somalia. He is addressing the 54 African Union nations tomorrow in Addis Ababa. There's not much point in on the Monday just blowing your relationship with everybody and then on the Tuesday expecting the African Union leaders to listen and respect and perhaps go along with what you're saying. So it's a tightrope. I think he's walked it reasonably well.
Daniela, do you go along with that? He has to strike this balance between, you know, pragmatism on the one hand and then being seen to be statesmanlike and to be seen to be sort of espousing the views that he holds dear. Do you go along with him? Do you think he's done a fairly good job balancing that act?
He's done a super job for his own ratings the last couple of... And I've been very impressed from that point of view. I mean, his visit to Kenya, yes, he was critical and carefully critical. But also, his visit basically redeemed the Kenyan leadership. And see, everyone seems to have forgotten very quickly that the president and the vice president were not so long ago about to stand trial in The Hague for war crimes. And America has been cold-shouldering them over recent years. But this is it now. Red carpet treatment for Obama, a bit of mild criticism. Everything is fine. All is forgotten. Now, I think Tim's right. It's all about al-Shabaab. You know, the Americans have made the judgment that what is most important at this juncture is security in East Africa. I mean, one of the reasons that the Kenyan leaders didn't appear at The Hague is because Nairobi didn't cooperate fully with the prosecutor, withheld lots of important bits of evidence. Lots of witnesses somehow changed their mind and decided they weren't going to testify. And there wasn't any significant Western pressure on Kenya to do things any differently. I think similar things are in play here. And it's very nice that that Obama is saying, look now, you know, careful now, you know, you should do a bit better. It's a little bit of a sideshow.
Tim, we've already touched upon this a couple of times then, looking at this role in weakening Al-Shabaab, and Obama mentioned, Ethiopia as an outstanding partner in that particular confrontation. You mentioned this AU speech as well. Outstanding partner, yes. Is there enough of a unified front? Is there an effective enough grouping to actually tackle those problems as we go forwards? Does Obama trust that he genuinely believes or worries about this into the future, despite the fact he's only around in office for a little while longer?
He does worry, and the United States worries at a strategic level. I mean, there's a number of things going on. I'll mention three of them briefly. One is the Al-Shabaab and the Somalia, but there's a second one down right across the Sahel. And I know that we're talking about East Africa at the moment. When you start moving up, the Sahel is a sort of vague concept. And then I'm now looking ahead to the speech to the AU. He also needs many African countries to buy into the fight against various Islamist terrorist groups across the Sahel. And he needs their bases to fly his drones. So he also has to go in reasonably gently. And the third thing of many is that China over the past decade has surpassed America as the biggest investor in Africa, and it is getting a lot of traction, and it's loads of things. For example, there's a superhighway being built from the Democratic Republic of Congo right out through Angola to the coast. Tanzania's port is being built by Chinese money. And so America wants, having lost a lot of ground, needs a bit more of that action economically. So again, he's got to talk to all 54 of them. I agree with Daniela that, you know, if you really wanted, you could say a lot more harsh things about the leadership of the countries he's been in. He has fudged it for geopolitical reasons.
Well, let me ask you about that, Daniela, because it's interesting what Tim's saying there about sort of making up this ground lost by the US. Is there a risk then implicit in that strategy that you do end up maybe not legitimizing, but giving credibility to a government that, as you know, as Tim says, jails a lot of journalists, has a questionable human rights record? We sort of seem to be suggesting he's got the balance about right, but does this government gain credibility that it should not be getting simply because of the rhetoric from Obama?
Well, being honoured with a visit from an American president is an exceptional honour. But then if any American president is only going to visit countries with impeccable human rights...
short trip.
Well, he'll be going to Oslo and back, basically. That's it.
Briefly, on the gay rights thing as well. I mean, he could go to every single African country because most of them it's illegal. And it is illegal, homosexual acts for men or women in Ethiopia. But he's kind of made a Pan-African point in Kenya. And is there any point in going to country after country after country with lecture after lecture? And then with the economic aspect of it, because the Chinese don't do that when they go there. They just say, do you want a deal? Let's do a deal.
But this is also about Obama. I mean, the Obama-Kenya visit was fantastic. Family members, dad dancing, all kinds of stuff. A joke about his passport or birth certificate. I mean, you know, really, he has it sewn up. He's on a roll right now, Obama. I'm not sure if he'd done this visit a year ago, it would have turned out quite so spectacularly well. Well, we've still got the speech to the African Union to come.
Obama's also having talks with regional and local leaders and addressing the South Sudan conflict. We'll go into his pushed for peace in a moment. But before we do, let's hear what James Schneider, senior correspondent at the New African magazine, had to say on M24 a little earlier today.
His engagement with South Sudan, I think, is actually very important. This civil war has been going on since December 2013, and both the principals, both sides, have been playing everybody who's tried to mediate essentially as fools. And they've managed to keep themselves off full sanctions list. They've managed to keep themselves off being directly targeted because they have to be brought together in some way. And they've been, I think, dragging out these negotiations as long as possible. And at some point, a harsher line has to be used with them. And that is what Obama is going to be pushing for now. And I think, again, like in Kenya, the way in which he is able to do these things is that he doesn't appear like a finger-wagging outsider. There might be the odd bit of finger-wagging, but he isn't saying, we are the West, we know better, you must do these things, now we're going to do sanctions. It's very much an inside-outside engagement where he, as I say, he can be this critical friend, where he can go and say, yeah, Ethiopia is fantastic, it's a great ally of the US, it's got this fantastic economic growth, blah, 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 great development, but you have these other problems. And he also doesn't shy away from problems in American society to highlight the fact that societies aren't perfect and it's the process of them becoming better that is important.
That was James Schneider a little earlier today. Tim, do you think James has got that right? Obama's good at being, a critical friend, not a finger wagger, with the words he was using.
Yes, and even though it's relatively superficial, I mean, I do think you do need to go and make gestures, and he has made gestures. I mean, and this was less naive, what he's been saying, because it's more achievable than, say, the Cairo speech of 5 years ago, which was just utterly naive and has been proved to be so, and saying, I'm going to close Guantanamo after a year, utterly naive. So I think he has learned to rein in his optimism. The realities of power have done that to him, and I think he does do a good job. And I thought James made a very good point there, that he is not just one of these finger wagging, you know, look, you guys, you need to do better. He also makes sure to say, in my own country, because I mean, one of the recent interviews when he talked about how sad he was about the gun crime, you know, tens of thousands of Americans dying, whereas only a few die in terrorism, and yet one seems to be more important than the other. I think he's pretty good at balancing that. And few leaders do that. Few leaders go abroad and say, you know what, my place isn't that good either.
Daniel, how do we sort of score Obama's visit to East Africa? And obviously it's kind of ongoing. But he does seem to be, you know, he's clearly doing that slightly second term thing of trying to be the international statesman. Can he chalk this one up as a sort of a great success, do you think?
If we score it for how well Obama comes out of this, so far, you know, 10 out of 10, he's doing very, very well. I wish we'd seen this kind of spectacular missions in his first term.
Indeed. Let's move on to Turkey next. From the Turkish military going after the PKK to a new agreement between Turkey and the US in the fight against Islamic State, to a last-minute NATO meeting planned for tomorrow due to the escalating violence in the country. Where do we start with this? There's so many different strands. Tim, I guess one of the first things that a lot of people will have been saying over the weekend and into today is, why is Turkey attacking the PKK when the PKK is seemingly one of the most effective means to help the West in the fight against IS? Is there an obvious answer to that question?
There's a complicated answer, which I'll try to boil down. I think it's a very, very stupid move that they've done. I think the Incirlik Air Base deal, whereby the Americans can fly out of Incirlik, is a very, very good move and will end IS. It's part of their destruction, and possibly Assad's as well, which I'll try and get onto. But it's the YPG, it's the Syrian Kurds who've carved out a de facto little state right on Turkey's border, Turkish-Syrian border. It's Rahavio, they call it. And the Turkish elite are terrified that if and when this war ever ends, there'll be a little Kurdish state on their border. And as this 20% of Turkey is Kurdish, well, they're not going to stop there. They will try and carve out more. And so there's this dual schizophrenic approach whereby they are now finally going to go up against Islamic State and hit them, and allow the Americans to hit them harder. But they couldn't resist also going up against the PKK because they fear the Kurds so much. I think it's ridiculous. I hope it calms down. If the PKK can just sort of get a form of words to say, okay, let's get that truce back on, because the truce has been on for 2.5 years. Before that, 40,000 people died in Turkey in the war between the PKK. But that's what's behind it. It's the fear of a Kurdish state. Very briefly on Incirlik, the Americans can now do 24/7 cover. They can be above IS for 24/7, whereas before they had to fly out of the Gulf. So they can take more payload, they can fly more often, they have less to get back, they've got more ability to go and rescue pilots. I mean, it's a big move, this Incirlik Air Base, and it's been overshadowed by the shelling of the PKK.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Turks are helped in this by the fact that the PKK is viewed as a terrorist organisation. There have been all kinds of conspiracy theories flying around as well, that what's behind this, all this about Erdogan is going to have, there's going to be elections later this year, and this is he's putting a marker down. I haven't seen anything convincing any convincing evidence of that. But it is a very, 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 very careful game they have to play. They have to play now. Mm. And there's talk of a no-fly zone. I mean, the Americans aren't calling it that. They're being very careful about language as well. But they were talking about this in 2011. You know, the idea there was this going to be this safe space along the Turkish border. It's taken 4 years to come to fruition, if it works. And I hope there is it will have a humanitarian knock-on effect. That's a major issue, which I don't think it's had much attention.
I think it's going to happen. Not an official no-fly zone, and not a... I still don't see the Turks crossing the border in force. But what I think is going to be, there's going to be 60 miles long and up to 30 miles deep into Syria, whereby any hostile force, if it's Syrian army or ISIS, will get battered in that space. It reaches almost down to Raqqa. And therefore, in that space, the anti-ISIS and Assad forces can train and recuperate, but also the civilians can hopefully get some respite. 60 miles and 30 miles deep, it's quite a big space where they are safe-ish and there's somewhere to flee to. One thing that's inside that area is a town called Dabiq. Dabiq is where the world comes to an end, in if you're of that Islamic persuasion, like Armageddon in Israel. It'd be fascinating to see if they stood and fought for Dabiq, because that's where the last battle between Christianity and Islam is supposed to take place in their theology. So watch for that town.
Watch that space. And now it's interesting, you mentioned this notion of this sort of slightly... you know, confusing the situation within Turkey as regards the PKK. You have a number of pro-Kurdish, the PDP, for example, spokesmen saying this is the end of that ceasefire, which you mentioned, Tim. How much of a problem is that for Erdogan? If that view takes hold, which would be understandable, yes, to say the least, what does that present for Erdogan then?
There's been a very relatively low-level tit-for-tat between the PKK and the Turkish forces over the past month, which is what has led to this. It has not escalated to the level where neither side can back down. There is still some wiggle room for Erdogan and the PKK to come to an agreement and put the ceasefire back into place. And the Turkish people, both Kurdish Turks and non-Kurdish Turks, are desperate for the ceasefire to continue. They do not want to be fighting two wars simultaneously. They don't want to take on the Kurds and IS. So despite all this apocalyptic doom that the civil war is about to erupt, yes, that is a significant danger, but there is still time for them to climb down and then both concentrate on Islamic State.
I think it's also important to note that this ceasefire was supposed to be a part of talks towards a more comprehensive and long-lasting agreement, and that hasn't happened. I mean, there hasn't been any action on that. And like so many other occasions in this region, this is about containment and management of seemingly irreconcilable forces. So I agree with him that I don't think the ceasefire is lost beyond all hope, because that really is all that's on the table.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Tim Marshall and Daniela Peled are my guests. Coming up next, political union and multiculturalism in the EU. Up for discussion. Stay tuned.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the programme as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the programme that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, our guests today, Tim Marshall and Daniela Peled. Now let's turn our focus to the European Union. In the aftermath of the Greek crisis, Italy's finance minister Pier Carlo Padoan has called for a deeper eurozone integration. He stated that a political union was the only way to save the common currency, which, according to him, includes the completion of a banking union and the establishment of a common eurozone budget. Daniela, this will confuse, I'm sure, some listeners to the show and to Signor Padoan, because is he talking about a political union? It sounds more like a more advanced fiscal union. And they may also think, well, hang on, isn't this more or less what we're supposed to have already?
Well, I think in some ways he's right. If you want to have a fiscal, if you've got a common currency and you want to have a fiscal union and you want it to work, then you kind of do need to all be integrated under the same system. But, you know, good luck selling that to the electorate of Europe right now. It's interesting that the Italians have just seemed to decided to speak up. And usually they're quite happy to let Germany and France take the lead. But this is a frankly ludicrous proposal when you think about the way that ordinary people, voters in Europe, see the European project right now. It's kind of a bad time to bring this up, I think.
I wondered, Tim, though, whether any of the people who bring up these ideas actually do spare a thought for what your man in the street actually thinks. It seems to me quite
well, when they do and they don't like it, they just keep asking them until they give them the right answer. This, I actually think, does make sense. You may have heard me droning on this programme in previous times that the idea of ever closer union in the EU, not the Eurozone, is dying before our eyes. And I stand by that. And this is actually part of that. This is about two-speed Europe. This is about those countries inside the Eurozone coming together with a fiscal union, which I agree is the only way to make it work, like the way they do in the United States, where you pool all the money and the sovereignty. That doesn't go down very well. And therefore, you can transfer funds to Greece, for example. So I think it makes perfect sense. François Hollande in France has come up with a similar but different idea for this. Schäuble in Germany has come up with something akin to it. There, within the Eurozone, there is this now move, and even Merkel might back it, that yes, we've seen this disaster of this year. We do need to have ever closer fiscal and political union within the Eurozone. And they're going to try and make it work. The electorates, especially in the periphery, don't like it, but they have not completely turned against the European Union. And I think as it's an idea that's floated, they're going to spend the rest of the year talking about it, and I don't think you can rule out them going for that. But it is part of two-speed Europe.
I just wonder, Daniel, it's interesting what Tim cites there. You have the Schäuble version, the Hollande version. We're talking about the Padoan version.
Yeah, but they're all talking about closer fiscal union.
But isn't the problem that there's three different ways of talking about the same thing? And that remains the problem, which is that you're never going to get even these guys sat around a big table in Brussels to agree, far less the voting public.
Well, they might eventually agree, but I must say that the whole idea of a two-tier European Union and working towards that and actively developing, I find a very depressing prospect. And I say that as somebody who is supportive of the project in general, I think it will lead us to worrying places. It's okay, it's going to be natural that two or three countries with the largest economy dominate the union, but this is going to get a little bit out of hand. And people haven't, you know, the public haven't abandoned the European project either. But I think more needs to be done to build up some sort of faith in this as well. Economics is all about emotion and psychology as well. And I don't think that can be excluded when you're talking about Europe.
So where are we at the moment? I mean, this is a kind of a big question, but people often talk loosely about, you know, the European project. People talked about the challenge which was presented. A lot of criticism about Germany, which we talked about before, sort of people suggesting they were showing their true colours over the Greece debate, this sort of thing.
Unpleasant and unneeded.
But where does it leave us in terms of even the common understanding or the collective understanding of what the European project actually is? You know, is it a social union, fiscal, financial, political? Is it become too nebulous now for it to even be mentioned as a singular sort of idea?
Well, it is fracturing as an idea, and it is unravelling at the periphery. However, I actually think that throughout the union, there is still a clear majority of people that actually get it. They understand why the union exists. They like the idea of why the union exists. I think there's also, certainly in this country, there is a view that perhaps it's gone too far, and when it was just the EEC, that was about its limits, but then it went for ever closer union. But I really think that, honestly, throughout the continent, that basic idea of 70 years of peace and prosperity, I know NATO has kept the peace, but so has the EU, peace and prosperity, I think that's still there. And I think if you can just make the argument and perhaps bring a little bit more democracy into the European Union's decision-making processes, I think it will survive. But I agree with Daniela, if there is going to be a two-speed Europe, and I think there is going to be, that will make it very difficult. But I think the idea of a loosely united Europe will be with us sometime to come.
Let's move on finally and talk a bit about, I guess, a social or a socio-political facet of this same discussion, which is about immigration. In Europe, again, it's making the headlines. If we look to the Netherlands this time, the mayor of Rotterdam, Ahmed Aboutaleb, showed concern over anti-Moroccan sentiment in his country, how he fears even that at some point his own parents would be ordered to leave if the likes of Geert Wilders from the ironically named Party of Freedom is to be believed. Daniela, do you think that this shows, well, certainly an admirable willingness from the mayor of Rotterdam to engage with some pretty difficult questions, but does it show that, you know, there's a great deal within a number of countries within Europe of still contradiction, confusion about how best to handle this issue, which still appears to be very divisive, unfortunately?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the dominating themes of the last decade and probably decades to come. And the Netherlands has a perhaps an international image of being very tolerant, a very inclusive society, but there are fault lines and there are some very extremely conservative trends developing there, not just with perception of immigrants, but also issues such as gay rights and other civil issues. So I'm not surprised with this. Geert Wilders makes an enormous noise. I mean, he's a super provocateur. But we've seen all over Europe similar parties emerging. I would like to say with great national pride that in Britain, the worst you've managed to do is Nigel Farage, which compared to other European European anti-immigration groups, you know, looks pretty respectable.
But he can stray into the comedic side rather than the more sinister.
But he still
speaks to a demographic, even in this country, which many of whom espouse some pretty unpleasant attitudes about people who don't look and sound and talk and behave in the way that they like.
Absolutely, he can stray, but I think the British public, I think we've shown this over and over again, is very, very far, very, very suspicious of anything that strays across a certain level of acceptability. I mean, I think we're pretty xenophobic, perhaps, but we're too polite to do anything about it.
Tim, it's one of these things about personality, and you've got this charismatic mayor, Ahmed Aboutaleb, who's talked to Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, when our forecast publication came out at the end of last year, and Andrew wrote about how he so eloquently speaks to both, as it were, sides of this discussion. Is it just a lack of frontline politicians, mayors, civic leadership, who are as erudite and who are as good at galvanising people? Is that one of the things that we lack?
But look, every country has them. I remember Harlem Désir in the early 80s in France came through, and in this country various people have come through. David Lammy, I find, a reasonably charismatic chap. Sorry, he may be standing for mayor next year for Labour. On Aboutaleb, he's charismatic, but the key thing he took on was Wilders' argument about getting rid of people. He said, OK, I want you to tell me, how are you going to do it? And the moment he said that, you're thinking cattle trucks. Because, you know, he's getting that into our heads. Because that is the bottom line, rounding up people and sticking them on trains and getting them out. So if that's what Geert Wilders means, he's trying to call him out to make him say it. And then we all know where we are. And I think that he's done a very good job. Briefly on Farage, I'm neither a fan or an opponent of Farage in this country, the UKIP. The 4 million people that voted them voted for them a couple of weeks ago are a response to the complete lack of our political class of taking any notice of huge sections of society, including those that don't like the EU. And now the left of Britain, left wing, are coming out and saying, well, actually, really, we don't like the EU. We've spent 20 years sneering at white working class people, sneering at them, calling them little Englanders because they didn't like the EU. Oh, we've decided we might not like the AI. They're such snobs. And because of the left-wing snobbery, UKIP has risen.
There, I'm afraid we shall have to leave it today.
Sorry about that, Daniela.
I'm sure that wasn't personally directed.
Many thanks to my guests today, Daniela Pellet and Tim Marshall. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us on the programme. That's all we have time for on the show, which was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Thanks to our studio manager, Chris Chilvers. More great music on the way next here on Monocle 24. Culture with Robert Bound at 1900 London time. This show, Midori House, is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800, here in London. Join us then from the Monday team. It's goodbye.